Session number 6447, reel 3.
Colonel John Roberts, tape 3.
Now, where had I got to? I had just said that I'd been ashore, say, 3/4 of an hour, and during this time I had, in fact, sent... I took a very small amount of people ashore, in fact. I told Guy Sale, the Welsh Guards commander, that I wouldn't take any stores because I didn't want to keep the vessel for long. That would have meant handling stores. All I took were my radio vehicles, my blood trailers, and one of my surgical teams, plus my command post personnel. 20 people in all. And we went ashore. I sent the remainder straight up to the community centre to liaise with the dressing station, the advanced dressing station, which was already there, with my adjutant and my MTO. And I, myself, went to brigade, explained to them about the Welsh Guards and the ship, that there was no way they could get to Bluff Cove as they intended to in the landing craft, and that we must get helicopters. And I was able to give them the numbers I'd taken before I left, the exact numbers and the weight of freight the Welsh Guards required to move. I had all this listed, and I handed all that to brigade and told them exactly what was required to get the Welsh Guards away. And I then went up to the community centre myself, by which time my surgeon had started to lay out how he wanted the theatre. He couldn't actually lay out the theatre because it itself was still in Galahad. In fact, both of them were still in Galahad. But this was the stage we'd reached when the aircraft suddenly appeared and attacked the two ships. We were all absolutely stunned. When we saw the airplanes at first, of course, we thought they were Harriers. And then we saw these black plumes of smoke everywhere and we realised they weren't. And suddenly the sort of fairly sleepy atmosphere of Fitzroy became quite electric. I ran into both the building, and I told the people in there we will be getting casualties shortly. I then ran, having run into the building, I then ran round to my tents about 100 yards away, told the people there that we would be getting casualties soon, and break out the kit. What little kit we had. And I then ran around Fitzroy settlement, stopping every civilian Land Rover I could find, throwing out whoever was in it except for the driver, and telling the driver to go straight down to the jetty, because I knew that casualties would be coming in. And I then went back and sat and waited, seemingly for an age. In fact, it was only half an hour or so before the first casualties came in, because the sky suddenly was alive with helicopters. Casualties were coming ashore by lifeboat and various other things. And it was at this stage that, of course, there was a second air attack. And I found myself standing shooting at airplanes. I think I've told you that. I'm not sure that's... it's a very medical officer type thing to do, but I think if one's unit is attacked, one is entitled by the Geneva Convention to retaliate, and that's what I was doing. So... finally, the casualties began to flow in, and the first 60-70 casualties, I think, we didn't even document them properly. They came in, and then other helicopters appeared. I hadn't even noticed this. I thought all the helicopters were evacuating the ship, but I realised then that it was pointed out to me, I should say, by one of my staff sergeants, that other helicopters had arrived and were taking treated casualties back to Ajax Bay. And we then had to work out some sort of channeling system, because we didn't even have a proper reception arrangement, of course, since we hadn't actually set up at the time. So the casualties came in. We later learned that we'd actually processed 135 men, nearly all of them with burns. I say nearly all because although we had some other more sort of... sort of physically traumatic injuries. We had a few amputations. I think we had 5 people who lost limbs. And a lot of people were concussed and stunned, having been thrown against bulkheads and so on. But most of them were burnt as well. This is the problem. Nearly all the casualties were burned. And one had a picture of seemingly hundreds of people, as I say, in fact, 135, but seemingly hundreds, milling about, walking around with their hands in the air, shouting, crying, some of them just very quiet, some encouraging others, others shrieking for assistance and asking for things for pain. the sort of problems that arise that people don't think of when sitting in armchairs is that how do you write on a chap's forehead that he's had morphia when his forehead is a mass of blisters and burns? How do you write on his clothing when his clothing's been torn off? These are the things that we don't think about until they happen. In the event, by about, after about 3 hours, I would say, they'd pretty well all gone, the casualties. It was only then that we discovered that a lot of our own men were looking a little tireder than perhaps they should have done, and they had rather red-rimmed eyes, and then we noticed that they also had burnt clothing. And of course it dawned on us then that our own men who were working on these casualties had been working on them from the moment of the attack on the ship, had continued to work with them all the way over, and were still working on them ashore. And it wasn't until our customers had gone that we turned to our own, and we treated our own casualties. And
your own casualties were quite severe enough, I think.
My own casualties, I had three killed. I had my second in command killed, Roger Nutbeam. Two of my soldiers, Preston and Private Preston and Corporal Farrell, were killed. And I had 18 wounded. Not all the 18 wounded, in fact, went through the books as wounded. And if you look at the records, you will see that 16 field ambulance had 9 wounded. This is because only 9, or we only elected to send 9 through the system. The remaining 9 actually came back and rejoined the unit. Because this was still the 8th of June, we sent them all casualties and all survivors of both ships were sent back to Ajax Bay, some for treatment and some just to be re-kitted and given new clothes and brought back. Back they all came, and my unit reformed on the 10th of June, which is only 2 days later. Reformed, we re-equipped, we had to borrow. In fact, it's a great sadness that the only photographs I have of surgery carried out at Fitzroy have HMS Hermes written over all the theatre sets instead of 16 field ambulance, because those were in Galahad. But we then managed to re-establish 2 surgical teams and a holding section on Thursday the 10th, and the final drive for Port Stanley started on the night of the 11th of June. And then, of course, the casualties started to flow in from there.
I think you said one of your staff, in fact, had a video camera with him.
Yes, this was very sad, because we'd had we had one of our people who had a video camera of his own, a lot of very, very expensive equipment. He had been taking video from the moment we left Southampton. He'd sent, I think, 2 tapes back from Ascension Island. He hadn't sent any back from Carlos, because, of course, once we arrived at Falkland, all sort of communication with the outside world ceased. But he had several video tapes recorded, and no doubt he was still busily recording on Galahad when she was hit. And sadly, he actually came ashore having lost all his kit, all his video kit. Although we have a lot of still, we had a lot of still photos, of course, but they too were lost. One or two people, including myself, had cameras with quite a lot of photographs that we'd taken on QE2 and on Norland and at San Carlos. But none of us took pictures at Fitzroy on the 8th of June, because we were frankly all too busy. I mean, I had ceased to be an administrator. I found myself on my knees trying to put up drips. You know, we were all involved. Now, Fitzroy itself is a small settlement. I suppose it's got of the order of a dozen houses, and it's normally a very sleepy little place, as are most of the settlements there. The sleepiness certainly disappeared on the morning of the 8th, but in fact, there was no damage to the settlement itself. The settlement itself was not bombed. There are a number of large sheep sheds there, and some of those would certainly have proved to be the ideal location for us to have set up the surgery. And in fact, I did come under some pressure to put the surgery in there, but I refused to do so because I felt that they really were targets. They almost had aiming marks on them. The sheep sheds there looked terribly like, from the air, they looked terribly like the refrigeration plant at Ajax Bay. And obviously, if one were in an aircraft and wished to attack what was known to be a brigade administrative area, the buildings would be the first things to go. And so I elected to go into the small community centre, which had already been picked for me. So although Fitzroy didn't actually have any bomb damage, as the days wore on, the settlement changed immensely because the population went up by a multiple, by several multiples. We had at one stage upwards of 1,000 people living in Fitzroy. This meant the water system failed. This meant the sewage system failed. In fact, every system failed. And we would have had a hygiene problem, but for the fact that we'd chosen to fight our war in a cold climate. I think if this had been in the Middle East, we'd have had terrible problems. I think while on, before I move too far away from the day of the 8th, I think I would like to say on the day of the Galahad thing, I would like to draw attention or record the actions of some of my men, because I think they do illustrate the way people do behave, and I'm proud to say the way people behave in extreme conditions such as these. On Sir Galahad at the time was the bulk of the unit, as I've said. My second in command, Roger Nutbeam, was killed, unfortunately, and a number were wounded. The regimental sergeant major, Mr. McHale, immediately got himself along to the front end of the ship, onto the forecastle, in fact, and there he set up I think I can best call it a casualty clearing station. And he shouted and screamed so that everybody brought casualties, any casualties they could find, were all brought up to the front end of the ship. And this is where he stood throughout the next 2 hours. He stood there. I'd like to remind you that there were three more air attacks during the time he was there. And he stayed on this ship, on the fore end of the ship, directing operations, directing the casualty evacuation, and marshalling the helicopters in and out. None of them, of course, could land, but they were all winching casualties up and down. I think it's worthy of note that the very last helicopter to leave Sir Galahad was almost exclusively 16 Field Ambulance. It had on it the captain of the ship, Captain Roberts, the captain of the ship. It had on it an unknown civilian. We've yet to find out who he was, a chap in a red sort of waterproof boiler suit, survival suit. We're not quite sure who he was. But practically everybody else on that last helicopter were 16 Field Ambulance. My regimental sergeant major, 3 or 4 of my sergeants, and 2 or 3 of my soldiers. I think that's testimony itself. But the RSM certainly was there directing operations, and I'm very happy to say that he was awarded the MBE for this. Other people who were on the ship at the time, there was a Lieutenant Colonel Jim Anderson. He was my senior anaesthetist. He was hurled to one side and fractured his clavicle, but he managed to help evacuating casualties. And in fact, he couldn't do too much on the ship itself except encourage people. But when he came ashore, he was wandering around with one arm in a sling, trying his best to treat casualties the whole of the time he was ashore. There was Jim Ryan, Major Jim Ryan, one of my surgeons. He'd suffered a heavy blow on the head. He was partially concussed. He had a certain amount of bleeding into his eye, and he did the most sterling work. He was quite remarkable, putting up drips, dressing, and in fact treating everybody quite magnificently until he... And he looked exhausted while he was doing it. Mr. Viner, the senior theatre tech, who was the one who'd come to Fitzroy the day before and come back to report to me, he'd inhaled a lot of smoke and he was having terrible trouble breathing, but he managed to go around encouraging people a lot. There was Sergeant Nyer. He was in the tank deck when the first bomb hit, and he was thrown to one side, was stunned, found himself sort of slithering down the bulkhead of the ship, was just picking himself up when there was a second bang. All the lights in the ship went out. You could still just about see, he tells me, through the hatch, which was open. But then the ship suddenly filled with dense black smoke and he couldn't see any more. Before this happened, he noticed that the two people who were standing next to him, behind him, just disappeared. And he believes they were just... Well, they just blew apart, he thinks. He's no idea. They were standing there 1 minute and they'd gone the next. He knows that his coat caught fire, the back of his coat and his large back caught fire, and his hair caught fire. and he was able to put out, and he managed to brush off the back of his head, which was all scorched, and he managed to throw off his burning pack, and he then made for where he knew the door was, because there was black smoke now everywhere. He got to the door, he felt somebody pulling at the back of his jacket, and he felt back and grabbed somebody's hand, led the man up two flights of stairs to daylight, this being the well deck, pushed the chap up the next flight of stairs onto the tank, onto the upper tank deck, and he then stayed on the well deck, cutting burning clothing off people as they came out with his scissors. He stayed there for some time doing this, and then he went up onto deck where he found a man with a leg blown off. He dressed the man as best he could, got three other assistants, and they managed to carry this man to the forecastle, where they evacuated him under the guidance of Mr. McHale. He then stayed. Oh, he'd already, I should have said, he'd already put a drip up on this man before carrying him forward. He then put up, certainly to my knowledge, he put up another three or four more drips, Sergeant Nyer, and eventually he was one of the ones who went on the last helicopter, having been quite a severe casualty himself. I'm glad to say, he received a military medal for this. There was a Sergeant Konushka who burnt his hands quite severely trying to remove burning clothing off a casualty. And he was delayed in undoing this burning clothing because he kept being pushed over by survivors. This was just, he was in the way, and survivors kept knocking him aside, and he kept returning to this burning man and ended up being casualty himself with severely burnt hands. And there were just so many more who ran in. Corporal Smith was the one who lost the video. He, in fact, managed to go down to the tank deck again, through all the smoke, fought his way down to the tank deck to fetch more dressings and more drip sets. He got a CNC's commendation. And many more, I mean, there are too many to mention. Corporal Riley, who threw himself onto a casualty when he saw the casualty was being trampled. He threw himself onto this casualty to protect him and got trampled himself for his pains. And then he carried this casualty himself forward. And he too was on the last helicopter. In fact, the last helicopter had on it Mr. McHale, Sergeant Nyer, Sergeant Konushka, Sergeant Girdleson, Sergeant Fur, Corporal Riley, Sergeant White. I mean, really, that's almost a helicopter load, and they were all 16 field ambulance. Ashore, my adjutant, Captain Coombe, Peter Coombe, he was ashore at the time. He saw what had happened. As the casualties came in, he was a theatre technician himself, he said to me, "I can't do any more here, sir. I'm going to go to the ship and see if I can recover some kit." And he managed to get onto the LCU, the landing craft, and went out to the ship, had to fight his way up onto the ship against the flow of casualties coming down, got into the well deck, opened the door, got halfway down to the tank deck before, frankly, beaten back by the smoke. He just couldn't see sufficiently, and he was coughing too much. He didn't reckon that there was any point in going any further. He came out feeling that he'd failed, noticed that that there were life rafts everywhere, realized that they had medical kits on them, first aid kits, and so he then took another little working party, and he took with him, oddly enough, the working party he took the Corporal Smith, who had already, on Galahad, gone downstairs to get more dressings, had then come ashore. Peter Coombe collected him and took him out on the LCU, back to the ship, to fetch more dressings, and also took with him my pay sergeant, Sergeant Spencer, who also got a CNC's commendation. And this little working party, as I say, they tried to get their way down into the ship to get kit. They couldn't do it. They then decided that they would take another vessel, and they took the Mexi float this time, and they then went round the bay collecting life rafts, A, for the medical kits they had, and B, because they knew that they would furnish accommodation for the and shelter for the survivors. And they dragged towed a number of these back, these life rafts. So all these men were incredibly brave, and I can say in all humility that I'm extremely proud of the unit. If that's a contradiction in terms, I'm sorry, but that is how I feel. Now, after the this incident, as I say, all the ones who'd been on the ship, in other words, most of the ones I've mentioned, all had to be sent back to Ajax Bay. Some of them, rather like my RSM, almost had to be ordered back. My RSM said he was determined he was not going back. He was quite capable, sir, thank you very much, of staying here. And I insisted, I won't say I ordered him, but I insisted that he went, and back he went. But 2 days later, they all bounced back again, and we set up the surgical complex. And from the night of Friday the 11th, right through to the 14th, right through to the 15th, in fact, they were operating flat out all the time as the casualties came in. And the two surgical teams I had were the one with Colonel Bill McGregor, Malcolm Jowett, that was his team, and the other one was David Jackson was the surgeon, and Amit Banerjee, the anaesthetist. And they worked, I mean, they performed the most heroic surgery I've ever seen in my life. And I just don't know how they managed. All the time, muttering that their surgical tutors would be horrified at the butchery they were carried out, and this isn't true surgery, and so on. But the fact is that they saved lives, and they also saved limbs. There were many casualties who came through that, frankly, I would have thought would have lost some of the limbs that they managed to keep. But Bill McGregor, particularly, was quite extraordinary, preserving what looked like dead limbs to me. And a lot of these people, some of them lost them later, yes indeed, but some didn't. And Bill McGregor, as you know, got an OBE for this, and deservedly so. They were quite marvellous. And I don't think I...
John, while all this was going on, clearly an awful lot was going on further ahead towards Port Stanley. Did you get very much news of what was happening?
Well, it was very curious. The news came in sort of stops and starts. On the 8th, obviously by Sir Galahad being hit and two companies of Welsh Guards being rendered ineffective, because even those who weren't hurt were stripped of all their kit and they lost their weapons, that sort of thing, the brigade had suffered a setback. The intention had been that the two brigades, 3 Commando Brigade to the north and 5 Brigade to the south, would both converge on Port Stanley along the mountain ranges which went along the top. Now, 3 Brigade, the Commando Brigade, were poised up on Mount Kent and Mount Challenger and had been for some days. And the delay was waiting for 5 Brigade to come round and consolidate itself at Bluff Cove. This, I imagine, is where the Bluff Cove of the newspapers has come into it all, because that is where 5 Brigade was meant to concentrate. This was all delayed somewhat, but gradually 5 Brigade assembled itself, and the final thrust for Stanley started round about midnight on Friday the 11th. By this time, my unit was reassembled. We'd got the surgeons ready, and we were waiting for custom. We'd had the orders group. We knew when HR was meant to be, as I say, round about midnight. I look at the diary. Where was it? I think, yes, 0001, 1 minute after midnight, was meant to be HR, on the morning of the 12th, if you like, the night of the 11th, morning of the 12th. And we knew what the objectives were. We knew that 3 Commando Brigade would have to take Mount Longdon, Two Sisters, and Harriet, all of which, I'm sure, newspaper stuff to everybody. And those were the... we knew that was those were the objectives for tonight, as it were. And indeed, they did exactly that. The first we knew, of course, from where we were, we could see these mountains, which were only 15 or so kilometres away. We could see them quite clearly. And the sky would light up, rather like firework night. We could hear the noises, rather as dull thumps more than cracks, but we could see the bright sky, we could see the tracer, we could see the anti-aircraft, we could see everything going on. And it was really quite eerie because we were waiting for casualties and they didn't come. And we waited and we waited and waited. And finally our first casualties came through just before first light. The Navy helicopters couldn't fly because they didn't have a night flying capability, nor in theory could the Army ones. But the difference is that in a Navy helicopter, you've got a very big aeroplane under a tiny bubble on top. And the pilots, to their embarrassment, weren't able to fly. They kept apologising to me, and I kept telling them not to worry. I understood. But the little aeroplanes, the little helicopters of 656 Squadron, that's Major Colin Syburn and his people, were quite beyond belief. I mean, I think they should have had a unit DFC, quite frankly, a large one, because they were magical. They, their little helicopters were flying from very, very early in the morning of the 12th, and they were flying in the dark with torchlight, and they were picking up casualties and bringing them back. I think our first casualties came in about 7 in the morning, when it really was very dark indeed. And they came in, and the first ones were people from 3 Para, who, they were mine injuries from Mount Longdon. And they came in, quite the worst injuries I'd ever seen. And I saw worse later, but at that stage, they were the worst I'd ever seen in my life. And they came in and were pounced upon by the 2 surgeons and worked upon. And from then on, right through the day of the 12th, we had casualties coming in, because as daylight came, so more and more helicopters were able to fly, and the casualties came. We were able to hear over the radio as the various... No, that's not true. We didn't hear over the radio the how the objectives, whether they'd been taken or not. We learned more from the patients as they came in. And as patients were coming in, it was a race, really, as to which one asked them first. What hurts, or how far have we got? And we found we were asking the casualties almost at the same time. Well, how did that happen to your leg, and where were you? And we found ourselves saying, well, exactly where were you when this happened? And writing little dots on maps and thinking, well, in that case, they've got so far towards Mount Longdon. And this was the sort of way we were able to build up our battle map. Gradually, as the day wore on, the day of the 12th, the influx of casualties fizzled out, because most of the fighting took place at night. Because we were fighting on mountains with sort of valleys in between, the name of the game was to take your mountain before daylight, sit tightly on it, having dug your hole, so that you could withstand the artillery barrage, which inevitably came by way of retaliation. And you sat there all day long while this artillery pounded down. The unlucky ones got hit, and hence why I got a trickle of casualties during the daytime. But most of my casualties came at dawn on the 3 subsequent days, because they'd been sustained during the dark, because as each night came, there was a further leap forward to the next lot of mountains, and casualties would be sustained. And so most of my casualties, say, came in at dawn. And this really was how we got the news from the casualties, as the various objectives were taken. I think it just about wiped out.